Hi everyone, thanks for joining us today for a Zoom seminar. Today it's a pleasure to introduce Udipan Banik. Udipan is a PhD student at Yale who during his PhD has done really pioneering work on gravitational physics and dynamics. We'll have a few minutes for questions for Udipan after the talk. And there's also a Google Doc to sign up for Zoom meetings with him afterwards during his virtual visit. So if you don't have the link, just email me and I'll send it to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the introduction. And thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure to be presenting at Perimeter, my PhD work that I did with Frank van den Bosch at Yale University. And my other collaborators, Martin Weinberg, Catherine Johnston, Jason, Adrian, and Elise, with whom I started working when I went to CCA, Dynamics Summer School. So my PhD has been about gravitational encounters and the gravitational dynamics of n-body dynamics of collisionless systems. And so, yeah, so mostly going to talk about the collisionless dynamics of galaxies and dark matter halos in the context of perturbation theory as well as non-perturbative techniques that I have developed. So gravitational encounters are ubiquitous in astrophysics. It happens all the time. The large-scale dynamics of the universe is governed by gravity. Various scenarios such as the orbital evolution of satellite galaxies and host galaxies, or galaxies in a cluster, in which case the subject, that is the satellite, can infall under dynamical friction towards the center of the host, and can also lose mass because of tidal effects of the host. So this is one case where you find gravitational interaction between the satellite and the host. Then you have galaxy-galaxy encounters and mergers that can happen when two galaxies, the gravitational encounter, and in this process, it can lose the orbital energy of each of these galaxies and dump it into the internal energy of the stars. And that's how you can have galaxy mergers to happen. Binary black holes, when they are orbiting around each other in the Keplerian potential, they also lose their energy and angular momentum to the surrounding stars and gas and dark matter because of dynamical friction. And that's how you can you get these black holes to in spiral towards each other by losing angular momentum before the gravitational wave in spiral phase takes over. So all these scenarios involve one thing in common, that is you have a subject which is being perturbed by an external perturber. So there are two timescales, the two frequencies, which are important when we consider any case of gravitational encounter. And those are the encounter or the perturbation frequency and the intrinsic frequencies of the motion of the stars or field particles inside the subject, which can be a galaxy or a dark matter halo. So in this simplistic case where I'm showing an example of an encounter between a subject and a perturber, which is moving along a straight line with a uniform velocity at a certain impact parameter, there are three possible limits of three limits of gravitational encounters that we can think of: the impulsive, adiabatic, and the intermediate regimes. The impulsive limit is valid in the very outskirts of the subject, where the stars or field particles are going to move at frequencies much smaller than the perturbation frequency, which is given by the ratio of the velocity to the impact parameter of the encounter. So since the stars are moving at much smaller frequencies, they basically don't have a lot of time to interact with the perturber because it's moving at larger frequency with respect to the stars, and therefore you can neglect the internal motion of the stars as you compute how much energy is going to be exchanged between the perturber and the stars. This is the regime which is valid for tidal shocks, for example, that subhalos or satellite galaxies experience as they undergo pericentric passages in the host galaxy. And the very opposite extreme of the adiabatic limit is valid in the central part of the subject, where the stars are moving with frequencies much larger than the perturbation frequency. So in this case, within one perturbation time scale, the stars are going to move many, many times back and forth. So your net response is going to get washed away over time. And therefore, the orbits of the stars are not affected much. And therefore, the actions or the conserved quantities of the orbits remain conserved. And this is why it's called adiabatic shielding. So the central part is going to be adiabatically shielded from the external perturbation. But most of the actions actually happen in the intermediate region, where the stars' frequencies, the intrinsic frequencies, are going to be comparable to the perturbation frequency. And that's when you have resonances, that is, your frequencies are going to be commensurate with the perturbed frequency. And these resonances are ultimately responsible for the maximum energy and angular momentum exchange between the perturber and the stars. And that's how you get secular, what is known as secular evolution, or which happens slowly at a time scale much longer than the typical dynamical time of the system. And in other words, in popular language, this is known as dynamical friction. So the stars are going to respond to the perturber, and this back reaction of the response on the perturber manifests as what is known as dynamical friction that is going to drain energy and angular momentum from the perturber. So in my talk, I'm going to talk about these different regimes of gravitational encounters in different geometries, such as in case of a disk galaxy or a spherical galaxy, which is being perturbed by an external perturbation. So the formal way to treat the perturbation of collisionless systems is by considering, of course, the collisionless Boltzmann equation, which is a time evolution equation for the distribution function of stars or dark matter particles in the system. So this is basically the phase-based density, how many stars are there per unit phase-based element, that's given by F. And basically the way that F changes over time is by influx versus outflux of stars from this particular phase-based element. And also, if this influx is not equal to the outflux, then there will be a local time derivative as well. It will change as a function of time at a particular phase-based point. So that's given by this term, del F del T, and the flux is basically given by the Poisson bracket of F with the Hamiltonian, because this entire dynamics is being governed by a particular Hamiltonian of the system. Now, in the unperturbed steady state, your Hamiltonian is time independent. So the galaxy has reached sort of a steady state. So your F is also not going to change over time. And so this drops out, and your F is therefore just a function of Hamiltonian and the other actions, conserved quantities of the system. But now we are interested in what happens when the system is being perturbed. That means that we can introduce now a perturbation to the Hamiltonian, which can be a time-dependent potential. And what that does to the system is that this now introduces a perturbation in the distribution function. And if your perturbation in the potential in the Hamiltonian is weak compared to the unperturbed galaxy Hamiltonian, then your perturbation in the distribution function is also small compared to the unperturbed distribution function. And then you can expand this F as a perturbation series, forget about the higher order terms, substitute this in the this original equation, and get a time evolution equation for the linear response of the system, which depends on how your perturber potential is going to change as a function of time. And this linear response also, of course, depends on your galaxy Hamiltonian and the unperturbed distribution function. So this equation is basically what I'm going to solve under different scenarios for different geometries of galaxies and for different kinds of perturber potential. So the philosophy is that you perturb the potential, you perturb the distribution function, which is synonymous to perturbing the phase-based quantities of each star. And
excuse me, may I interrupt to ask? So, yeah, so you're assuming F1 is small, but in the case of resonance that you mentioned earlier, I could imagine F1 can become large. So, kind of, there can be circular effects, as you mentioned there, before. So, yeah, so how do these two things match? Yeah.
Yes, very good question. So, F1 is small, as you said, only away from resonances. And in near resonances, your linear perturbation theory fails. So you have to you have to do a canonical transformation to a different set of action angle variables, which are known as slow and fast action angle variables, where the slow action and the slow angle change quite a bit, but your fast action and fast angle do not. So your perturbation theory still holds for the fast action. So I have a slide later about this. I'm basically going to talk about that. But yes, near resonances, your original action angle variables, the original actions are going to change very, very much. So your perturbation theory doesn't work. Standard perturbation theory, linear perturbation theory doesn't work. And that's one of the reasons why I moved to a non-perturbative picture of dynamical friction later, which I am going to talk about in the second part of my talk.
Yes. I see. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So this linear perturbation theory that I'm talking about holds as long as the stars and the perturber are not spending long enough near a resonance. If the perturbation is happening fast enough such that the stars move in and out of resonance before the nonlinear perturbations develop, then this linear perturbation theory is okay. But as it happens, that's not always the case. And therefore, in the slow regime of perturbation, when there are resonances between the stars and the perturber for a prolonged period of time, your linear perturbation theory is not going to work. Right, but let's assume for now that the stars are not near resonance with the perturber for long enough, then your linear perturbation theory holds. So that means that you can compute this linear response in the distribution function, which means that you can also compute the perturbations in the orbital elements of the star. So that's an equivalent sort of description of this process. Now, before we consider the perturbation in the orbital elements, that is the how the positions and velocities change, we want to characterize the orbits of the star. And those are characterized by what are known as the action angle variables. The actions are typically synonymous to the sizes of the orbits, the amplitudes of oscillation of the stars. And those in 3D, there are three degrees of freedom, so three actions. And corresponding to those three actions, there are three angles, which are the phases along the orbits in these three directions. Now, for a time-independent Hamiltonian and also in presence of certain symmetries, in which case your Hamilton-Jacobi equation becomes separable, then you can write down your Hamiltonian as a function of these actions. These action angle variables exist, and these actions are basically given by the integral of the momentum in the over the position. And your angles now in this case change linearly with time. It is a periodic system. So, and the frequencies are given by the derivatives of the Hamiltonian with respect to the actions. So each star can therefore be thought of as a combination of three oscillators. And there is a canonical transformation that you can do by using a generating function from the position velocity space to the position momentum space to the action angle space. Now, if your Hamiltonian is spherically symmetric, your potential as well is spherically symmetric, then your Hamiltonian and as well as angular momentum is going to be conserved, which means that the orbital motion is going to happen in an orbital plane that is characterized by the angular momentum. And the only two frequencies that are going to be relevant for the problem are going to be the in and out radial frequency and the round and round azimuthal frequency along the orbital plane. But in case of an actually symmetric potential, for example, a disk, your potential is just a function, is now a function of both R and Z. So it's a function of the cylindrical radius and the vertical height from the disk, from the midplane. So all three frequencies along three different directions are going to be relevant because the star's motion is not going to happen in an orbital plane like this, but this basically this plane is going to precise about this axis of symmetry, which is given by the z-axis. So as I was talking about earlier, that you can think of this perturbation in two different scenarios. One is the Eulerian approach where you perturb your distribution function, and the other is the Lagrangian approach where you look at the perturbation of the orbital elements of the star as you're moving with the star. So in the two limits, the impulsive and the adiabatic limits, the orbital elements change in a very different way. In the impulsive limit, where the perturbation is happening much faster than the motion of the stars, your velocities are going to change. Those velocity changes are basically given by this time integral over the force, or the perturbing force. But the positions are not going to change much. So that's the impulse approximation. in the adiabatic limit, both positions and velocities can change, but the actions are going to be invariant as long as you are away from resonances. So this is a very key thing. But as I was talking about, that once you have resonances, then your actions and angle variables are going to change a lot. And in that case, what you do is that you corresponding to this particular resonance, for example, where I'm considering a perturber that is moving in a circular orbit, so it only couples to the third degree of freedom, which is the azimuthal motion. So for this particular resonance, you can always make a canonical transformation from the original action angle variables to the slow action and slow angle and fast actions and fast angles. And these are slow action and angles are basically linear combinations of the original action angle variables, which are I1, I2, I3, and W1, W2, W3. And the slow angle is basically nothing but the time integral of this resonance condition. So as the name suggests, this changes slowly over time. By slowly, I mean much, much more slowly than the typical orbital frequencies of the stars. And the corresponding slow action, which is given by I3 by L3, in this particular case, this also changes slowly at the same rate as the slow angle changes. But the fast actions are going to be invariant over time, and the fast angles are going to change at the same rate as the unperturbed angles change. So this is basically the crux of secular evolution. Near the resonances, your slow action and angle are going to change much more slowly than the typical orbital frequencies, and that is how you get this slow or secular evolution near the resonances. So near the resonances, basically your actions are not going to be adiabatically invariant. You can always find these sets of slow and fast actions. The slow action is going to change, fast actions are not going to change, and therefore the adiabatic invariance of actions is partially broken near the resonance. So I'm going to come back to this slow concept of slow and fast actions in the later part of my talk, where I'm going to talk about dynamical friction in a non-perturbative approach. So in the first part, I'm going to talk about these three different regimes of gravitational encounters, as long as the stars are not going to spend a lot of time near the resonance, such that our linear perturbation theory holds. And this I'm going to talk about in the context of the perturbation of disk galaxies by external perturbations, and how that response of the disk galaxies to the perturbation phase mixes over time and results in the formation of what is known as a phase-based spiral or a phase spiral. So disk galaxies are very prone to perturbations, are very susceptible to perturbations because they are highly ordered, sort of low entropy systems. So if you perturb a disk, that perturbation basically can get amplified and takes a very long time to die out. Our own Milky Way galaxy is not in equilibrium. It is always being perturbed by different things like satellite galaxies in the halo, for example. And there are many non-equilibrium features all across our Milky Way galaxy, like the spiral arms, the warp, the bar, and also recently discovered non-equilibrium features in the solar neighborhood, which are known as phase-based spirals, which correspond to vertical bending waves. Now, this phase spiral was basically discovered in the vertical distribution of the stars, the velocity versus position, the vertical phase-based distribution function, the vertical phase-based distribution of the stars, you find that there is a spiral feature. If there was no perturbation, this would have been a smooth distribution. But the fact that you find a spiral means that there was a perturbation in the recent past, and now this perturbation is phase mixing over time because of different oscillation frequencies of the stars. Now, this phase spiral holds a lot of information about the frequencies of the stars and therefore about the potential in which the stars are going to move. And therefore, we can constrain the Milky Way potential as well as maybe the dark matter distribution of our galaxy using this phase spiral. We can also do galactoseismology. That is, from this nature of this phase spiral, we can say what kind of perturbation hit the disk, and therefore we can think about constraining the dynamical history of Milky Way. Now, what are these phase spirals? How do they form? So here I'm showing you an illustration of what happens when you give sort of an impulsive perturbation to the stars in a disk. let's just focus on this part here. So this is for a vertical bending mode, which is an n equals one mode. It's asymmetric about the midplane. So initially, due to some kind of perturbation, you just give vertical velocity impulses in one direction in this region. That results in a dipole in the phase space just after the perturbation, which ultimately gets wrapped up into a one-arm phase spiral because of different oscillation frequencies. So the stars near the central part of this plot, which have smaller actions, oscillate much faster because they're closer to the midplane, experience a lot more gravity. But the stars in the outer part are going to oscillate much slower. So they are going to circulate at much smaller rate in this plot. That's why you basically wrap up this dipole pattern into a spiral. There is another mode which is important, which is the breathing mode. That's the n equal two symmetric mode. So here at a particular point, you basically create a quadrupole initially because the stars for positive Z are going to get positive delta VZ, for negative Z get negative delta VZ. So you create a quadrupole which gets wrapped up into a two-armed phase space spiral. So already by looking at the nature of the spiral, whether it's one-armed or two-armed, we can say that what kind of perturbation caused this on one-armed spiral is caused by a bending mode, which is anti-symmetric, and a two-armed spiral is caused by a breathing mode, which is symmetric. Again, we come back to our favorite linear perturbation theory for collisionless systems, which in this case is a disk galaxy. So this unperturbed distribution function corresponds to a disk galaxy. And I am basically going to perturb this disk using some kind of external perturbation, which is given by this 5P, this perturbable potential. So we have this linearized form of the collisionless Boltzmann equation. And then for the ease of calculations, we go to the action angle space because the unperturbed distribution function and Hamiltonian are just functions of actions and not angles, because we assume that the unperturbed system is entirely phase mixed. And on top of that, you're introducing a perturbation. And now we also do a Fourier series expansion in angles. So your F1 and phi P, the linear response and perturbable potential, are both going to be expanded as a Fourier series in angles. And that's because your system is basically periodic. So you can do this discrete Fourier transform. And then you can get a time evolution equation for the Fourier coefficient of the linear response once you specify the Fourier coefficient of the perturbable potential. So this equation is like a forced oscillator, where if you do not have the right-hand term, which is the perturbing force, the perturbing term, then you just have this, which basically means that your distribution function is going to oscillate at, the response is going to oscillate at different frequencies, three different frequencies, omega one, omega two, and omega three. That's how you get your phase mixing of the response. But once you have some perturber, then this response is going to be modulated by the perturbation. And you can solve this equation easily using the Green's function technique, for example, and get an equation for the linear response of the system. This is a time integral, the time integral over the perturbable potential modulated by this phase factor, which consists of the frequencies of the stars. And this is ultimately going to be responsible for the phase spiral, this term here. So this perturber, how it has been changing over all past times, that is important for the linear response. And also this scales as a gradient of the distribution function with respect to the actions. So you need to have some non-homogeneity in the system in order to get some response, because if everything was homogeneous, then there will be as many stars going this way as that way, and everything would be washed out. So, but if you have more stars with larger actions as opposed to smaller actions, for example, then you have then you can develop this response once you perturb it. And this perturbable potential can be anything. It can be a bar or a spiral arm, or it can think of a satellite galaxy that is impacting the disk at a particular angle with in a certain orbit with a velocity vp. And in this part of my talk, I'm going to focus mostly on the satellite galaxy encounter with the disk. This is just a slight digression here. So when I was solving the linearized collisionless Boltzmann equation, I was just taking the perturbable potential into account, but actually there is another term which is called the polarization term that consists of the self-gravity of the response itself. Because you are developing an overdensity in the stars because of this perturber, that overdensity itself feeds into an additional gravitational potential. And that also needs to be taken into account if you want to do a self-consistent solution. But what this does is that, so you basically have to solve your linearist, collisionless Boltzmann equation as well as the Poisson equation self-consistently. But what that does is that you get this first term that I just showed you, that is the phase particle term. This is a transient sort of feature, which ultimately gets wrapped up tighter and tighter in the phase space. And basically, after phase mixing has reached completion, you won't be able to tell this feature in the phase space anymore. So this is a transient term. But there is another term which are called the normal modes or point modes that follow a dispersion relation. These occur when you take into account the Poisson equation. And these normal modes for a collisionless system are basically, they undergo Landau damping. And the Landau damping happens typically over the time scale of a few dynamical time, at least in case of an isothermal slab, I checked that. So these Landau damped oscillations, which are coherent oscillations of the stars, these will damp away. And therefore, when you want to talk about the phase puddle, these are decoupled from the phase puddle in the linear theory. The total response is just a superposition of the two. So you can think of these coherent response, and on top of that, there will be this phase mixing of the response. So for the phase spiral, it's mostly this part that is important and not this normal modes. So that's why for the rest of my talk, I'm going to ignore the effect of the self-gravity of the response for the phase spiral.
Excuse me. Yeah, I'm not sure I understood this argument. Yeah, can you perhaps go again through it? I mean, while Landau damping is not important, is it just because it's damped faster than the phase mixing happens, or what?
Yeah, that's part of it. The Landau damping happens quite fast. So I checked that if you for an isothermal slab which is homogeneous in the lateral directions but has a vertical profile, isothermal profile in the vertical direction, in that case the Landau damping happens in the order of like 3 to 4 dynamical time. But that is not the only thing why I'm neglecting. The fact is that it's like a coherent oscillation. So all the stars are going to move at the same frequency. So these normal modes have the same frequency for all actions. So this has no effect on the phase spiral whatsoever, because the phase spiral only originates because these frequencies of the stars are going to be functions of actions. And this first part is basically it has this term here where this omega k is a function of actions, and therefore this is going to result in this phase mixing or the wrapping up of the pattern in the phase space where you get the phase spiral.
I see. So Landau damping on this phase space diagram would be kind of like breathing the whole picture, yeah, scaling it up and down, right? Inside.
Yes, Landau damping would basically make this weaker and weaker over time. The total response will be weaker, but yes, and also, yeah, it's like a coherent oscillation. So the phase spiral happens when you go to the frame of this coherent response. Then you basically can neglect this thing, and in that frame, you basically only find this vertical phase mixing, this part of the response.
Okay, I see. Thanks.
But there is also a catch here. It can be amplified by self-gravity as well. So there will be these normal mode oscillations, plus there can be some amplification of this response because there is a response matrix that will enter here, and that can be something other than one. The determinant can be something other than one. So you can get an amplification that can lead to a factor of 2 or 3 enhancement of this of the response of the amplitude of this phase spiral because of self-gravity. But if you're concerned about the shape of this phase spiral, that should not be affected by these presence of normal modes.
Well, and what determines if there is amplification or damping? What determines this?
Yeah, as a function of time, it will damp away, but the amplitude of the oscillation, the overall sort of normalization, that can be larger if you take into account the self.
I see. Thanks.
Okay, so For now, I am going to therefore neglect the self-gravity of the response and just going to focus on this first part, which causes the formation of phase panels. So I am plotting that response strength as a function of velocity of a satellite. So this is a Sagittarius-like encounter, a Sagittarius dwarf galaxy having an impact with the Milky Way disk, where I take into account the full disk distribution function. I assume a vertically isothermal, nearly isothermal, and a radially exponential profile for the Milky Way disk. And I also consider the presence of a dark matter halo, which is considered to be an NFW profile, but that halo is not responding to the perturber. That is the first sort of simplification that it can do. So the halo is basically sort of like a static thing, which is only going to play a role in governing the frequencies of oscillation of the stars. But the disk is being perturbed, and I'm plotting that response strength as a function of velocity. The different lines show different angles of impact. The blue line is perpendicular, and red line is nearly parallel. And Sagittarius is shown here by the red dot. As you can see, that more parallel encounters create stronger response. That's because you basically spend a longer time near the disk for a more parallel encounter. And impulsive and adiabatic limits both show that the response dies away for large velocity because there is not enough time for the stars to respond. And in the small velocity limit, it dies away because the stars move around much quicker within one perturbation time scale, and therefore the response gets washed away and you have an exponential suppression in the adiabatic limit. But for when you have sort of a resonance between the stars' frequencies and the perturbation frequency, which is given by the velocity divided by the impact parameter, then you have a huge boost in the response, which can sometimes even go nonlinear. And that's when your perturbation theory actually doesn't work in this regime. But as long as it is smaller than one, you are fine with the linear perturbation theory. And Sagittarius sits quite close to this resonance. And that's why you get a huge response from Sagittarius in the solar neighborhood of the Milky Way disk. So I'm going to skip that one slide. And so I did this exercise not only for Sagittarius, but for many other Milky Way satellite galaxies. And here I'm plotting this response strength for the bending mode as a function of the crossing time of the satellite. So multiple points basically mean that the satellite is crossing the disk again and again. Sagittarius is a red dot, and this is LMC. I did this for Hercules, Leo 2, Segway 2, and other satellites as well. And this is basically sort of like the Gaia detectability threshold. So anything above this is possible to detect with Gaia. And from this, we can see that Sagittarius is by far the strongest perturber in the solar neighborhood among the Milky Way satellites. LMC comes somewhat close, but this interaction has not yet happened. This is time t equals zero, so anything to the right is basically in the future. But if you look at the past interactions, the Sagittarius dominates over the others by at least 1 to 2 orders of magnitude. So it is the strongest perturber among the Milky Way satellites, and therefore it is the strongest contender for having caused this Gaia phase spiral. But that being said, it doesn't necessarily mean that the Gaia phase spiral was caused by Sagittarius. It could have been caused by a transient bar or spiral arm, or there can be other things that might have caused this. But if you want to think about the satellite galaxy source, then Sagittarius is the strongest contender. Okay, so for the next part of my talk, I'm going to talk about the intermediate regime.
Yeah, can I
ask a question before you move on?
Sure.
So can you go back to the previous slide? Oh yeah. So I'm just wondering, is there anything we could test? I mean, I think you provided like a mathematical picture, but I mean, we have some data. So what aspect of, I guess, your model can be tested with the data? I mean, I guess we're not going to wait a few giga years to test this. So given the data that we have, is there something that we could test basically?
Yes, that's a very good question. Yes, there are things that you can test. Basically, I can generate this phase spiral for different models of perturbation. So I did this for a bar or a spiral arm that is sort of growing and decaying over time, and also for satellite galaxies. So once you specify the form of the perturbation, you can generate this phase spiral. You also have to specify the particular Hamiltonian which governs your frequencies. So once you specify the frequencies of the stars and the perturber model, then you can generate this phase spiral. And the idea is to now compare that phase spiral to the observed phase spiral. That is sort of the forward modeling kind of approach that you can do. You can also do one thing that once you observe this phase spiral, and then you, I have a slide, I think, on this. Right. So this is about constraining the potential, for example. You can sort of, let's say that this is an observed spiral, and then you need to sort of backtrack this. You need to unwind this spiral by, you can assume sort of a potential for the galaxy, and then you can compute the frequencies from that. You can unwind the spiral using those frequencies, and then see whether you can get sort of a smooth pattern by unwinding the spiral. And you can get a smooth distribution only if you assume the correct form of the potential. If you assume an incorrect form, you won't ever be able to get a smooth distribution by unwinding this spiral. So that is one way where you can sort of think about constraining the potential, for example. That's one sort of way that you can use your data. And as I'm showing here, this is actually sensitive to what you assume for the potential. So in this case, I have assumed both a disk and a halo. In this case, I've just assumed the disk, and that changes your frequencies. So for the disk and halo case, you basically have a more tightly wound spiral because your frequencies, because your d omega di, which governs your phase mixing time scale, that is actually the phase mixing time scale is smaller because your d omega di is larger if you consider the presence of the halo. So there are things that you can do with okay. this model competitive. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
So maybe I also want to follow up this question. So can you discriminate between some halo perturber and the bar, or anything else? Is there any feature kind of specific for subhalos?
Yes, very good question. Yes, the bar or the spiral arm, for example, it depends on the. On the vertical profile of the potential, for example. If you have a bar, let's say, so this is the master equation, and this thing. So it depends on what your perturber is. A bar can have both n equals one and n equals two modes, but usually the n equals one mode is the vertical, the n equals two mode is usually the more dominant one for a bar or a spiral arm. Whereas for a satellite galaxy, you can excite both n equals one and n equals two. And also it depends on the speed of the perturbation. So I didn't talk about that. Let me talk about that a little bit. So here I'm plotting, again, for the satellite galaxy case, I'm plotting the breathing over bending ratio. So the ratio of the n equals two to the n equals one mode as a function of the velocity. And this I'm showing for two points of impact. This is for a Sagittarius-like encounter. Again, the impact happens on 20 kiloparsecs away from the galactic center. And this is for the solar neighborhood, and this is farther away from the solar neighborhood and closer to the point of impact. And if you move closer and closer to the point of impact, you basically find that the breathing modes dominate over the bending modes. So if you have this transition from one arm phase spiral to the two arm phase spiral, then you can say that wherever there is a two arm phase spiral, the perturbation that is happening has to happen faster than the typical vertical oscillation time period of the stars. So this perturbation time scale, which is the impact parameter by velocity, if this is smaller than the vertical oscillation time scale, then you have a bending mode. If this is larger than this, then you have a if this is smaller than 1 over omega z, then you have a breathing mode. If this is larger than 1 over omega z, then you have a bending mode. So closer and closer to the point of impact of the satellite galaxy or R decreases, then you basically, this thing decreases, so you have more breathing modes. And farther away, you have more bending modes, because farther away, you basically find that the satellite perturbation is happening very slowly. And also, it depends on the velocity of perturbation. So this is one way that you can think of sort of constraining the perturbation that is causing this. So if you have a bending mode or a one-arm spiral, that means the perturbation that had caused that must have happened slower than the vertical oscillation timescale, and vice versa for the breathing mode.
I see. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. For a bar or a spiral arm, you can get a similar sort of thing. If your bar or spiral arm is growing and decaying fast enough, then you can have a breathing mode. But if it is, given that your perturbable potential is symmetric, has a symmetric component, but if it is happening very slowly over time, then you get a bending mode or a one-arm spiral.
So just to follow up on that even more, so for the phase space spiral that you were showing, that was, I guess, like measured over some volume centered on the sun, right?
Yes.
Well, so how large actually is that volume? And so could you, measure the same thing for, for different locations?
That's right. I think this is sort of 1 kiloparsec box size about the solar neighborhood, as far as I am aware. It's like this is the Gaia volume that was that was identified as a solar neighborhood in the Gaia DR2. So this is Gaia DR2, 900 million stars, if I'm not mistaken. And this is within 1 kiloparsec of the solar neighborhood. But yes, as you said, you can do this at different points of the disk. And that is basically what people are doing now in Gaia DR3. You can go much further in as well as a little further out. And so by looking at how this phase spiral, the nature of this phase spiral changes as a function of radius, you can sort of think about constraining how the perturbation that had caused this was also changing as a function of radius. Mm-hmm. And you find in the inner disk that the phase spiral in Gaia DR3, it looks two-armed versus one-armed. In the inner disk, it is two-armed. In the solar neighborhood, it becomes one-armed. And a little further out, it is also one-armed. So that means that in the inner disk, whatever has caused that phase spiral, that perturbation must have been happening much faster than the vertical oscillation timescale. And in the solar neighborhood, it's slower than the vertical oscillation timescale. Now, for satellite galaxies, if, for example, you look at the Sagittarius, you find an opposite trend further out in the disk, because the impact is happening further out, you find more two-armed spirals, more breathing modes. But in the data in Gaia DR3, you find the opposite. You find that in the inner disk, you find more breathing modes. So that means that whatever has caused those inner disk phase spirals must not have been Sagittarius. It could have been some other dark object that had passed through the inner part of the disk, or it was a transient spiral arm or bar or something that had caused those two-armed spirals in the inner disk. So yeah, there are all kinds of things that you can do. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. One more question, actually, like while we're talking about this. So here you're showing just like the vertical phase space spirals. Are there analogs you can do in the plane of the disk?
Yes, definitely you will have a phase spiral in the plane of the disk as well. So instead of VZ versus Z, if you, let's say, plot, V5 versus R or VR versus R, then that would also show a phase spiral, because your radial and azimuthal frequencies are also functions of guiding radius or functions of angular momentum. So you will find a phase spiral there as well.
Right. But presumably, for like a bar perturbation versus like a satellite perturbation, so these like in-plane spirals presumably would be quite different for those two scenarios, right?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's a good way to think about it. So yeah, instead of just looking at the vertical, if you look at the azimuthal phase spiral, then those two would be different, and you might be able to break the degeneracy by looking at two different phase spirals. That being said, the frequencies are only functions of angular momentum and vertical action, and they depend very weakly on the radial action. So there are only, I think, two phase spirals that will be prominent, and the third one won't be that prominent. Right, because you need to have the frequencies to be functions of actions. In order
Okay, great, thanks.
Cool. All right. Right. So I will talk a little bit about the dynamical friction stuff now, moving on to the resonant regime of the response. And in that context, I will be talking about what is called coarse stalling and dynamical buoyancy, which are very curious secular phenomena in a chord galaxy as opposed to a cuspy galaxy. So I will basically tell you that, show you that dynamical friction operates very differently in a chord galaxy versus compared to a cuspy galaxy. So dynamical friction is the key relaxation mechanism in collisionless systems. It is one of the major ways in which you lose angular momentum and energy and in spiral towards the center of a host galaxy. A massive perturber can in spiral towards the center of the host. Galaxy mergers, galactic cannibalism, which is the infall of galaxies in a cluster. Black hole mergers, also the initial phase of black hole mergers, and globular cluster mergers in the center of a galaxy due to dynamical friction causes the formation of bulges and nuclear star clusters. So all this vast range of astrophysical phenomena happen because of dynamical friction. So the standard picture of dynamical friction was put forward by Chandrasekhar. It is the most popular picture today. Chandrasekhar, 1943, gave a very simplistic sort of picture of dynamical friction, where you have a massive perturber move of a certain mass moving with in a straight orbit with a uniform velocity through a homogeneous background of stars. And the stars therefore move at nearly straight orbits, get slightly deflected from their orbits because of the perturber's gravity and form sort of an overdensity behind. And there, because of this momentum exchange, because there will be more stars coming from the front than from the back, you have a net gain of energy and momentum of the stars, and therefore a net loss of energy and momentum of the perturber. And that's how you get this drag reaction force on the perturber, which scales as a square of the mass and is linearly proportional to the density of the stars. So this is a fairly local picture because you are forgetting about the global curvature of the orbits of the stars and only taking into account their sort of how they behave locally, you know, close to the perturber. And also you forget about the density profile of the galaxy. So it's there are many approximations that you do here. Now, sort of a more robust way to think about dynamical friction is by considering this orbital structure of the stars in the galaxy, where these stars are now moving in rosette orbits instead of straight orbits because it's a self-gravitating system. And these orbits are again characterized by their tons of quantities or actions and frequencies. In the orbital plane, the stars move at two frequencies, the radial and the tangential or azimuthal frequencies. And the perturber is thought to move in a circular orbit for simplicity. And whenever there are resonances between these frequencies of the stars and the frequency of perturbation, which is a circular frequency, these resonant stars are going to respond the most to the perturbation and sort of form a global sort of overdensity that is lagging behind the perturber, and which therefore causes a retarding torque that drains the energy and angular momentum from the perturber, causing it to inspire. And this torque is known as the LBK torque, because it is this was first introduced by Lindenbell and Kalnaish, 1972, in the context of spiral arm driven angular momentum transport in a disk galaxy. In this case, instead of a spiral arm perturber, you have a compact massive perturber which is moving in a circular orbit. And but the physics is still the same. So this LBK torque is usually retarding in nature, is actually always retarding in nature. You always find that the angular momentum is going to be lost from the perturber, so it is always going to sink under dynamical friction. And only the resonant stars contribute to this LBK torque. Now, so there are these two complementary pictures, the local Chandrasekhar picture and the global resonance picture. Both of them have been found to work well in a cuspy galaxy when your host galaxy has a central density cusp. Then you find that the perturber goes all the way to the center under dynamical friction. Dynamical friction is very efficient. But if your galaxy has a central constant density core, then you find that the Chandrasekhar torque, for example, predicts that it should fall all the way in. But the N-body simulation result shows that instead it falls initially at Chandrasekhar rate, then it speeds up, and then it sort of hits a wall inside the core region and has this bounce back effect where it sort of gets pushed out instead of falling in. And then it stalls at a particular radius in the core and does not want to go into the core region anymore. Now, if you put this perturber, introduce this perturber close to the center of the galaxy, then it actually gets pushed out under certain circumstances and again stalls at this particular radius. So there are this curious phenomena of core stalling, which is this.
So can I ask here? So this pushing out, doesn't it correspond to positive torque? Because you said that torque is always negative. So I'm wondering.
Yes. So that's why the standard theory doesn't work here. So the dynamical buoyancy cannot be explained by the LBK torque and also by Chandrasekhar.
I see. So the theory predicts negative torque, but in reality, we get positive, right?
Yeah. So inside, you are getting positive in the core, at least in this particular Cole et al. 2012 paper. They found that one of these globular clusters near the center of the Fornax dwarf galaxy can get pushed out. Because Fornax has a central, if Fornax has a central dark matter core.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's basically what we were after. We wanted to come up with a theory that can explain this core stalling as well as dynamical buoyancy in a core galaxy. So in standard theory, this is based on linear perturbation theory. Again, you have the perturber potential, you compute the linear response, you compute the torque. And on top of that, you have two key assumptions. You make an, what is called an adiabatic approximation and a secular approximation. This is, in adiabatic approximation, you basically assume that the perturber is growing very slowly over time. So it's a slow growth of the perturber. And also, you assume the secular approximation, where you assume that the perturber is falling in very slowly under dynamical friction. So much, much more slowly than the typical orbital time of the system. And upon assuming these two things, you get what is called the LBK torque. And that I'm showing the expression for the LBK torque for the case of a perturber moving in a circular orbit. There are certain things that I want to draw your attention to. There's first of all this Dirac delta function of the resonance condition here. So this means that only when there are resonances, you get a non-zero torque. And also this scales as the gradient of the distribution function with respect to the energy. This is always negative for a stable system. And therefore your LBK torque is always retarding. It is always negative. All the other terms are positive definite. So you only get dynamical friction from the LBK torque. Now, why do we get only resonances? That's because of these two assumptions, because you're introducing your perturber very slowly to the system. That's why your near resonant orbits or off resonant orbits are going to get phase mixed away. This is just an illustration of different pendula with different lengths by which you basically kill off this coherent response over time because these move with different frequencies. And this ultimately ties again to the picture of phase spirals that I showed to you in the context of disk galaxies. These near resonant orbits will also result in phase spirals in the phase space. And only the resonant orbits are not going to phase mix away because those are in sync with the perturber all the time. Those stars are going to be in sync with the perturber. And so after infinite time, you're only left with the resonances. That's why you only get a contribution from the resonances in the LBK torque, because your perturber takes infinite time to get introduced into the system. But that is not how the real universe works. So we came up with a general theory where we do not assume this adiabatic or secular approximations. We sort of introduce the perturber instantaneously in the very outskirts of the system. For example, that's how the N-body simulations treat this problem of dynamical friction. And then we do not also assume the secular approximation because we compute this dynamical friction timescale self-consistently. So we compute the torque that introduces a change in the radius of the perturber that changes the perturber potential as well as the circular frequency. And that again gets substituted in the expression for the torque. And this is basically computed in an entirely self-consistent manner. So you do not have to make these approximations. Mathematically, what that means is that your Dirac delta function of the resonances in the LBK torque gets modified into a much more complicated temporal integral, temporal correlation sort of thing, where your self-consistent torque now depends not only on the perturber or on the perturbation potential at time t, but also on that at all past times. So this is integrated over time, and this is this modulation function sort of cosine of zeta, where zeta, instead of just being this resonant frequency, is basically now, it involves a time integral of the circular frequency of the perturber because this is also changing with time. So this is the by far the most general description for dynamical friction that you can have under linear perturbation theory. Physically, this means that this temporal correlation means that the torque now depends on the entire infall history of the perturber and not only on the perturber potential at the current time when you're computing the torque. And also you get a contribution from the near resonant orbits now because the orbits basically fall in and out of resonance. None of the orbits are going to be in resonance with the perturber for a very long time. So your linear perturbation theory holds. And so this is known as basically what we are calling the sweeping through the resonance is the perturber interacts with the resonant stars, but then these resonant stars again fall out of resonance as the perturber is moving in. So these two effects basically now lead to dynamical friction, as well as you can get dynamical buoyancy. Now, for shortage of time, I won't be able to go get into the mathematical details of how you get buoyancy out of this, but you can basically think of this as, so this is a memory effect. This means that your perturber basically remembers the sort of its infall history. So you can get this sort of a super Chandrasekhar friction. So the perturber basically starts falling in much faster and faster as it approaches the core, as I'm going to show you. So this is what happens when you have the standard Chandrasekhar. Radius decreases as a function of time. It goes all the way to the center. For LBK torque, you do find core stalling, as shown by this Karan Schrader 2018 paper, because basically your perturber moves at a circular frequency much larger than the central frequency of the stars in the core region because the perturber frequency involves the mass of the perturber. So that's why you basically kill off this core rotation resonances in the core region, and therefore you have a weakening of the dynamical friction torque. But you do not have this sort of dynamical buoyancy in this LBK picture. But by doing the self-consistent torque computation, we find this, that initially it falls at the LBK and Chandrasekhar rates, but then it speeds up because of this memory effect that I was talking about. And then at a particular within a particular radius, you find that this torque actually flips sign because your overdensity, instead of forming behind the perturber, it actually can form sort of slightly ahead of the perturber. So you can get sort of a pushback effect or dynamical buoyancy here. And then it stalls at a particular radius. And when you introduce this inside the core, then Chandrasekhar predicts it falls in, LBK torque predicts it stays there because the core rotation resonances have vanished inside the core. And however, the self-consistent torque actually predicts that after some transient oscillations, when the phase mixing is still happening, you get an overall trend of getting pushed out to, again, this core, this stalling radius. So this core stalling radius is like sort of a stable limit cycle because anything outside gets attracted towards this radius and anything inside again also gets attracted towards this radius. Right, so now this was all based on perturbation theory. In the last few minutes, I will talk a little bit about moving beyond perturbation theory because perturbation theory is problematic in the core region because of these reasons. First of all, your mass of the perturber has to be smaller than the enclosed mass of the galaxy within its radius in order for perturbation theory to strictly hold, because you need a weak perturbation. But coarse stalling occurs when your mass of the perturber is actually comparable to the mass of the galaxy. So this is problematic. Also, your resonances, the LBK torque, for example, has resonances between the unperturbed frequencies, but the resonances themselves change the actions and the angles of the stars, and therefore they also change the frequencies. So how is this consistent? And your linear perturbation theory is okay when the perturber is moving fast enough. It's falling in very fast. It has to fall in much faster than the typical aberration time of the resonant orbits. And that happens only when the perturber is far from the stalling radius. But near the stalling radius, the perturber is slowing down. And so when it is slowing down, the stars can spend a considerable amount of time near the resonance with the perturber. So the stars can actually now librate about these resonances and get sort of adiabatically trapped into resonant orbits. In that case, you can develop nonlinear perturbations quite fast. And you can have these large changes in energy and angular momentum of the stars. So perturbation theory doesn't work. So you have to move to a more sort of a general non-perturbative approach to describe how dynamical friction is happening near the stalling radius. And this now is in the context of slow and fast action angles variables again, because now the perturbation is happening very slowly. So once that happens, your stars spend a lot of time near the resonances. So you have to move to what is called a slow action and slow angle, as I was talking about in the initial part of my talk. And so that's what I'm going to talk about here. So what I do is that I consider this dynamical friction as sort of a restricted three-body problem, where I numerically integrate the orbits of the stars in the combined potential of the galaxy and the perturber, which is moving in a circular orbit. This is for the co-rotating frame. This panel is for inertial frame. This panel shows the energy of the star as a function of time. And this is for a co-rotation resonant horseshoe orbit. In this case, the Jacobi Hamiltonian is going to be conserved, even if the energy and angular momentum are going to change. But in the restricted three-body problem, this Jacobi Hamiltonian is conserved. As if I let it go, so initially the perturber basically pulls out the star from the inner part to the outer part. And as that happens, the energy increases. And then the star spends a lot of time outside the perturber's orbit and again gets pulled in by the perturber's gravity and comes to the inner part. So as this happens, the energy changes back and forth. And therefore, it seems as if you don't do anything because your energy comes back to the same point again. So how do you get a net energy exchange between the perturber and the star, which is what you need for dynamical friction? That's because there is a distribution function gradient along this orbit because of the density profile of the galaxy. You have more stars in the inner part of the orbit than in the outer part. So more stars are basically going to gain energy than lose energy. And therefore, on an average, the perturber loses energy. And therefore, you get dynamical friction. So this is one of the orbits. This horseshoe orbit is one of the key contributors to dynamical friction because it is a very nearly co-rotation resonant orbit. And this being near resonance, it has a very long libration time. It takes very long for the star to sort of drift and make 1-2 pi rotation in the co-rotating frame. So this star spends a long time near the resonance, and therefore your standard linear perturbation theory will not work if you want to compute the response of these near resonance stars to the perturber. So you have to move to the slow and fast action angle variables. And the slow action in this case is nothing but the angular momentum because this is near co-rotation resonance. There are other resonances also. And for those resonances, your slow action will be a different combination of radial action and angular momentum. So for this particular horseshoe orbit, as I was talking about, that there will be a larger number of stars in the inner part than in the outer part. And these stars initially, form this overdensity behind the perturber. There's a sort of like the Chandrasekhar wake. And then again, it again gets ahead of the perturber after some time as these orbits librate this way, because the perturber is moving that way, so the orbit is going to move in the opposite way. So initially you get this overdensity behind the perturbator, and therefore initially you get dynamical friction before the buoyancy takes over. But there won't be enough time for the buoyancy to take over, because as the perturbator experiences this initial dynamical friction, it is going to fall in. And then again, you will this orbit will have moved out of resonance by that time, and another orbit would have come into resonance. And then again, this process will keep on happening. So that's how you get dynamical friction to occur. So this is when the perturbator is outside the core. Now, there are other orbital families. When you have a core density profile, then you have this very interesting orbit, which we found for the first time. This is, we are calling this a Pacman orbit, because it has a very, because of obvious reasons, it looks like Pacman in the core rotating frame. Instead of taking a detour all the way above the L0 Lagrange point, which is the stable center at the center of the galaxy, it takes a shortcut between the L1 Lagrange point and the perturbator. And this orbit is also near co-rotation resonance, although it's a little farther away from co-rotation resonance than the horseshoe orbit. But the energy, again, takes a very long time to change in the co-rotating frame, so it has a long libration time. But instead of a horseshoe orbit, instead of dynamical friction from a horseshoe orbit, this orbit can actually result in both dynamical friction and buoyancy. Outside the core, it still contributes to dynamical friction. But inside the core, something very interesting happens. As the perturbator's potential dominates inside the core, initially you start with an overdensity of stars ahead and both ahead and behind the perturbator, because the energy is going to be much more negative in this part and this part than in this part. So there will be larger number of stars whenever the energy is more negative. That's why you have this initial larger number of stars here and here. And remember that the orbit is going to librate that way because the perturbator is going this way. So this overdensity is going to move behind, and this overdensity is going to move ahead, and this overdensity is going to move behind. So therefore, you get this initial overdensity that forms ahead of the perturbator instead of behind. And that's why you have this initial phase of dynamical buoyancy or positive torque from this orbit. And there will be many, many more Pacman orbits as you go further and further into the core. That's why you have this initial dynamical buoyancy rather than friction, which is going to push out the perturbator instead of making it fall in. And this transition from friction to buoyancy occurs whenever you have a steep enough core. You find that these horseshoe orbits, which contribute to dynamical friction, disappear, and all you are left with are these Pacman orbits in the core, which are shown by this green region. And this happens because the perturbator is massive and it sort of tidally disrupts the core. When this happens, there is sort of an overdensity, what is called the Roche slope overflow that is happening. And this is associated with a bifurcation of these Lagrange points, L3, L0, and L1. And the L0 Lagrange point, which is a stable center, that basically becomes an unstable saddle point as this bifurcation happens. And so there won't be any more stars going around the galactic center, because the core has been tidally disrupted, and all you're left with are these Pacman orbits. There are also other orbits like the Dipole orbits, which are going to librate about the L4 and L5 Lagrange points. So there is this transition from friction to buoyancy that you find in a core galaxy. But such a bifurcation of Lagrange points or tidal disruption cannot happen when you have a central density cusp, because the cusp is dense enough that it can survive these tidal disruption by the perturbator. So you do not have any bifurcation. Your horseshoe orbits are always going to be there. There are no Pacman orbits actually in a cuspy galaxy, and therefore you have ongoing dynamical friction in a cusp. And this is a bifurcation diagram again, which shows the radius as a function of this position, which is the position of the Lagrange points. In the case of a Plummer sphere, which has this constant density core, you find that this bifurcation happens. In a Hartree sphere, which has a cusp, there is no bifurcation. And I came up with a way to compute this bifurcation radius, which basically means that whenever this bifurcation is happening, your stability of the L0 Lagrange point is going to change from being a center to a saddle. So your double derivative of the effective potential is basically going to be zero. And when that happens, you have this bifurcation. And that bifurcation radius is therefore basically the radius where the stalling is going to happen. The perturber is going to stall at this particular radius. This is where you flip your sign of the torque from being negative outside to positive inside. Right, okay. So dynamical buoyancy and core stalling have a lot of astrophysical implications. Once you have a supermassive black hole in the center, you want the other supermassive black hole to come all the way into the center under dynamical friction, that can stop if there is a constant density core in a galaxy. So you can actually choke supermassive black hole mergers in core galaxies and create a significant population of off-center perturbers, off-center black holes. So this has implications for supermassive black hole merger rates from LISA gravitational wave observations, for example. You can also have stalled globular clusters in dwarf galaxies like Fornax. This has been used to argue that maybe Fornax has a dark matter core because many of these globular clusters that are quite massive have not yet fallen into the center of the galaxy. You find that they are floating around sort of in the outskirts. So maybe that indicates that Fornax might have a dark matter core. And as for these off-center perturbers, there have been some recent observations of off-center AGNs in dwarf galaxies. So that might also hint at something to do with the dark matter distribution in these dwarf galaxies. Maybe they have a core, that's why you have this population of off-center AGNs. But the basic thing is that once you make observations of many of these massive perturbers and look at the offsets of these perturbers, which can be black holes or nuclear star clusters, if there is a significant offset, then that favors a dark matter core rather than a cusp. Not only that, you can actually go beyond that even about and think about constraining the nature of dark matter, because for cold dark matter, which is what I was talking about, so I was only talking about collisionless systems that can be a galaxy or a cold dark matter halo. In that case, from the bifurcation criteria, you can basically compute the stalling radius, how that behaves as a function of the mass ratio of the perturber to the host galaxy mass. Now, this stalling radius is an increasing function of the mass ratio because the tidal disruption of the core is going to happen much earlier if you have a more massive perturber. So more massive perturbers tend to stall further out in the CDM halo. But for a fuzzy dark matter case, that is exactly opposite, because in fuzzy dark matter, the stalling happens because of different physical phenomenon. It happens because of a balance between the diffusive heating from the quasi-particles and dynamical friction. And the quasi-particles tend to get more and more massive towards the center. So a more massive perturber will tend to balance out the mass of the quasi-particle much closer to the center, and therefore more massive perturber is going to stall further in. That is exactly opposite of what happens in case of CDM. So we can think about plotting this offset radius of the perturber as a function of the mass ratio of the perturber to the host and see whether it has an increasing trend versus a decreasing trend. And that can tell you something, hopefully, about whether it's CDM or CDM. And currently, I'm working on extending this theory to self-interacting dark matter. So for cold dark matter or galaxies, you have a collisionless Boltzmann equation. So your right-hand term is basically zero. But in case of self-interacting dark matter, there will be interactions between the dark matter particles. So this collision term, you can think of approximating this as sort of in the BGK approximation way, where this basically is nothing but the collision frequency times the linear response. And all that does is that it changes the Dirac delta function at the resonances to a Lorentzian type function. So your dynamical friction gets weaker at the resonances and stronger away from the resonances because of these interactions. So that is currently what I'm working on. And right, so yeah, that's all I have today. Thank you for listening. I'll take questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Sudipan, for a really interesting talk. We're a little over time, but maybe there's time for just a quick question or two. And then I know many people have Zoom chat with Udipan's scheduled for later. Would anyone like to ask a question now?
Yeah, well, I have a question. I already asked many, but yeah, I have one more. So you mentioned as outlook to do well, calculation for fuzzy dark matter, well, compared with cold dark matter. So I wonder, so for fuzzy dark matter, apart from this granular structure, we also have a solitonic core in the middle. So I'm wondering if this plays any role in the dynamics that you're studying, how you take into account this. Because yeah, this core can freeze, it's kind of not static either. Yeah, it can have its own normal mode.
Yes. Yes. That's right. The soliton is not static. It can move around. It can sort of do a random walk because of interaction with the surrounding quasi particles, and it can also fluctuate over time. And that is a complication, but sort of. So the thing I was talking about here, I was mostly focusing on the quasi particles, and this was sort of found by this paper, Barrow and Fouvry and some others in 2019, where they describe fuzzy dark matter sort of as a combination of quasi particles, and they have this entire theory for relaxation in a fuzzy dark matter halo, where they looked at dynamical friction due to particles that are less massive than the perturber, and dynamical heating due to particles that are more massive than the perturber. As you are moving closer and closer to the center, yes, the soliton is going to play an important role. And the soliton, you can, I don't know, I mean, I think you can think of it as sort of like a very massive quasi-particle, which is not moving around like the others, because the other quasi-particles are sort of like interference patterns. They come and go, but the soliton is always there. And there have been other studies which have looked into the effect of this soliton on dynamical friction versus heating, because the soliton is doing this random walk that can actually result in an additional heating of the perturber. And if you have a perturber near the center, the random walk of the soliton actually tends to cause it to move further out because of this heating. And Dr. Chaudhary in our research group has done quite a bit of work on that simulation of perturbers in fuzzy dark matter halos, and he finds that this soliton random walk can actually make it go further out. And he also finds this trend of the stalling radius as a function of the perturber's mass, that more massive perturbers are actually going to stall further in. And
but I'm more wondering, in your formalism, can it be included or it's not?
Oh, okay. In my formalism, I think it can be included, although the physics is a little bit different. It's quite different. I mean, you can sort of think about perturbing the Schrödinger-Poisson equations to do this, because the fuzzy dark matter is governed by the Schrödinger-Poisson equations. And I think there has been quite a bit of work already in that dynamical friction is in a fuzzy dark matter halo. But by solving the Boltzmann equation, I probably you can think of an effective picture where this basically this collision term, this will take into account this diffusive heating due to the quasi particles. And similar sort of thing was done by Barrow and Fouvry already, I think. This will basically be sort of like a Fokker-Planck. You can do a Fokker-Planck approach where there will be a friction term and a diffusion term as well. And it's the balance of the two which decides which one is going to happen, whether it's friction or heating. I think it can be included in principle.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you.
Why don't we just pause here? But I encourage everyone to sign up to chat with Udipan later, and let's thank Udipan again for a really really interesting talk.
Thank you very much.